this is causing friction. This is the podcast where we get a little uncomfortable, a little awkward on our journey of healing through mindfulness and becoming self-aware.
All right. Welcome back to the podcast, everyone. Today, I have a very special guest in front of me, and I'm very excited because if you've been listening for a while, you understand the deep impact meditation has had and continues to have on my healing journey. So today I have with me Hector, and Hector, I'm going to let you introduce yourself, a little bit of your background and why you're here with me today. And then we're going to dive into meditation and healing and the importance of silence to really understand who you are, get connected, and have that mind-body connection again.
Awesome. Thanks so much, Danny. And hi, everyone. So my name is Hector Marcel. I'm old, so I'm going to do a dad joke. I was born when I was very young. There we go. That's my dad joke. I was born in Argentina and grew up in Australia. And in that cultural shift, like to be a little brown person landing in an ultra white Australia, I experienced, first of all, I didn't know the language, but I experienced some dissonance. And it was terrible, like it is for most people and most migrants and most people that don't get along. But, you know, later on in life, I discovered that it became a kind of superpower, the lessons I learned by being a different person. And so I started a career in organizational change management, meaning helping people that feel discombobulated with changes at work. I was helping them transition and make the best out of the changes because life changes. And so you can fight it or you can dive into it. Just like when I was a migrant kid, I hated it. I didn't speak English, but I figured my way around. And it was mostly around building stronger relationships with people, especially the people I didn't like. And so that around the same time, that led me to encounter a Buddhist monk who taught me really incredible things about the mind. And he challenged me to overcome deep-rooted impulses in the mind. And so I became a student of Tibetan Buddhist philosophy, and in particular, meditation. And 25 years later, I get to teach all that stuff around the world and to students here in our center in New York and the rest. But my passion, so that's a little bit of what I did and where I came from, but my passion is getting these ancient teachings, like these scribbles in Tibetan and Sanskrit that are only just beginning to come into the Western languages, and removing the dogmatic view that we will have of them. We're talking about 2,500 years of people like Danny and Hector and everyone that's listening, seeing that their minds are full of garbage and that garbage lens is preventing us from real happiness. And sure, they had their language 2,000 years ago or 500 years ago, but they're talking about the same thing. When your mind blocks you from happiness, what do you really do? And so there are all these techniques to meditate and focus. But if you know how to decode that, oh my God, can your life turn on fire? You know, there's still garbage to navigate. It doesn't mean that garbage disappears, but you can navigate it. You can dodge it.
Lots to unpack here, but I think that let's start with when I was going through a lot of your content and I was getting a better understanding of what it is that you do. It's really around being comfortable with being uncomfortable in silence and truly understanding the importance of silence. And can you explain a little bit? I mean, in order to go into a meditative state, like usually silence is the best form for getting into that. So let's start there. Let's start with why silence. Why is it so important to tap into our spiritual self? How can we do it? Because I know, like you said, it's the garbage, it's the chatter, it's all of this noise, external and internal. And ultimately, silence just means peace. It means internal peace and a fulfillment and joy. So let's go through that. Let's break that down. And I would really love to hear your opinion on why silence is just so important and how we can be okay with coming to terms with it.
Really happy you said a bunch of really good words in there, bliss and stillness and, you know, like joy. And when you study these things, they are really byproducts of entering a meditative state. You can't force them. You know, you can't just make them happen. Like love me, Danny. I force you to love. You can't do it. You know, it's something that you do. It comes over you, you know, and it's the same. Once you have a kind of stillness, which is called shamatha, and I'll explain it in a second. When your mind enters this kind of physical pliancy where you're relaxed, so relaxed that all your movements of mind also begin to relax, like an ocean, choppy ocean becomes like a still moonlit ocean that's, you know, glass almost reflecting reality perfectly, or reflecting the moon surface perfectly. You know, when the mind is choppy, when the ocean is choppy, let's say in the middle of a night, you can't see the moon reflecting. It's just fractals. That's our minds all the time. We're busy thinking of this, that, the other. When you quiet it down, when you still it, the surface of that ocean can be like a mirror, and you could see the moon's reflection as if it were the moon itself. You wouldn't know the difference if it was perfectly still. So that's one metaphor to say, why silence? Yeah. And it sounds sweet and nice. And a byproduct of that is like, there's this peace, and you can sense it, right? Just by the metaphor. Oh my goodness. No choppy, so peaceful. But that takes work. It doesn't just happen because you shut up. You know, we tell people to shut up all the time. They're not at peace. You know, like, we got told to shut up when we're little. We weren't at peace. So it's a funny thing that a certain kind of stillness will get you to that peace, but not just any. So you have to go through a little journey to get there. And I'm going to give you the bad news, okay?
Please do.
The bad news of meditation. But you know, I mean, we all know. We all know it's there. The reason for silence of, like, try and put yourself in a quiet spot, shut your mouth, don't talk to anyone, right? And just stop the audible sounds. What you're doing there is you're removing 1/6 of the mind's window to the world. Nothing to listen to. Yeah. You're also in a meditation posture. You also, like, sit still, like sit in one position, don't move. And now you're removing 2 windows out of 6 windows of consciousness that the mind is looking out and getting all excited about. There's nothing to scratch. There's nothing to move. There's nothing to walk towards. Sit your ass down. And so now the mind's like, okay, that window shut, that window shut. What do we do in meditation? We close our eyes. So we close the other window. Shit, there's only got 3 windows left. You know, nothing to taste also, nothing to smell also. So now imagine this, Danny. What the hell is Danny's mind if she's not looking at something, hearing something, tasting something, moving something, thinking something, right? And all of a sudden, you're going to find the real essence of Danny, that mind, the one that interprets what you see, hear, taste, touch. So that's why you want to sort of reveal the beautiful mind that lies behind the busyness of looking and seeing and tasting. And that's why we quiet our posture. That's why we quiet our breath. Now, physiologically, neuroscientifically, you can say that, you know, breathing deeply, closing your eyes will activate the parasympathetic nervous system and enact the stress response. You can do that just normal breathing. We're talking about a very different and much deeper state of consciousness that all of our minds have access to, but it takes some work to get there. So the bad news is we can shut those windows, sit yourself in a corner, be really quiet, shut up, close your eyes. And all of a sudden, you're going to get a little invitation to that still ocean water. And then very quickly, because your mind is so unused to being by itself, it doesn't know what to do with itself because it's forever busy naming, pointing, acting, thinking. So you're going to start seeing garbage about your mind that you hadn't seen in a while. You're like, oh, damn, that's still there. And you know, it'll come as a story of the past. It'll come as a hope for the future. And these are called meditation distractions. You know, it's the mind's resistance to actually diving deep into that still water. If you keep going in the still water, those thoughts and stories and turbulences will go away. And then you really get to tap into a much more substantial part of you. And that when you taste that, oh, you get addicted like nothing else. You're like, oh, I can taste that all the time. And when you come out of a meditation where you've tasted that stillness of yours, the world looks different, even though it's doing the same thing. So people might be yelling at you, but you have this kind of stepped back perspective. That stillness from your meditation follows you off the cushion. Meditation by itself isn't a thing. Like, boring, you're going to sit in a corner. It's not for that. It's to get a taste of what your mind can do, and then an invitation to let your mind do that where it really counts, which is someone's yelling at you on the street and you just don't get triggered. They can yell all they want, but you're not going to play because you're still inside. And that can happen, but it takes some training, of course, some habit, you know, like anything.
Yeah, I really love that you mentioned the word beautiful when you're talking about this, because I understand a lot of people's reservations and how intimidated they are to step into the world of meditation, because they don't feel that their thoughts, feelings, everything going through their mind is beautiful. They're scared of what is going to come up. They're scared of what from the past is going to come up. And that's where the instant gratification, the social media, the Netflix for hours, it's where all of this comes into play, because we just don't want to sit in silence because we're scared of what is going to come up. And I like that you said it is a beautiful thing to understand yourself and hear those thoughts, because it's really going to explain who you are. And it isn't going to be all sunshine and rainbows. We know that we're humans and we've been through experiences and we carry that with us, but there is a beautiful part about being safe in your own body. And that's something that meditation did for me. I was able to connect with myself, understand myself, feel safe in my body, safe in my mind. And being on the other side of that is why I so badly wish that more people could just see what I see, feel what I feel, because you're right. There's a different lens to life after experiencing the byproduct of meditation. So the joy, the calm, the peace, serenity, that new lens isn't something I would trade for anything else in the entire world. And I understand it's intimidating for people, but that's why I want to have conversations like this. It's not easy, but nothing that's good in life is easy. And this is something that is incredibly worth it. And getting to know yourself is the ultimate gift of love. It's something that we overlook, and we overlook the relationship with ourselves on such a profound level. We don't even consider ourselves when we think of who do we love in the world? Who do we want to care for? We're so low on the totem pole. And meditation, it is a form of self-love, but it's also selfless because of what it does for your relationships, what it's going to do for the way that you love people, you receive love. It's a really beautiful, all-encompassing way to just live life a little bit better.
So many of the things you said resonate with me. First of all, there will be hesitation for people, But here is a couple of answers that I've picked up along the way about those hesitations, because I've had them too. I've seen scary things in my meditation. I get itchy. I wanted to go away. I didn't want to face some things inside. So here is my number one answer. By the way, you'll get the sense that I'm an all-in guy. Like, I'll just dive in. You know, if I see resistance, I'm in, because I don't want to deal with a fight long-term with my own mind in particular, because I'll probably lose. So I just want to go in. So when I feel hesitation or resistance, I open the door and check it out. I don't run away. You know, so that's one thing that I'm lucky I have. But the other thing is, the thing that kept me opening the door to whatever hesitation I had to make a deeper practice or to make a commitment or to put in the hard work is think of the alternative. If you understand that meditation can do this goodness for you and your relationships in the world, what's my alternative? To never meditate and to keep stressing out and have the traumas in my life run and rule my world. And that's not an alternative for me. The reason I even considered meditation in the first place was because I had some stuff to deal with. The alternative is don't deal with the stuff. No. You know, and for me, substances weren't a way out of stuff, you know, like taking substances was just a bad band-aid that kept infecting the wound for me. You know, I know other people have different experiences. And also Western psychotherapy for me just dragged on the thing to death. You know, like it just dragged it on and never really gave me the onus that I'm responsible to navigate my own mind, which I do anyway. Yeah. And I'm not dismissing Western psychological approaches. It just wasn't deep enough for me, to be honest, you know? And so when I met this monk and I met Eastern philosophy, they were unashamedly going, and you said lens, this is very important. We all have a lens that has a certain bias, yeah? And it's associated to whatever happened to us in the past, whatever we did in the past, more importantly. And it's not the way the world is. It's just the way we see the world. And the fact that you can one day see it one way, another day see it a different way, means our lenses can change and our experience of reality can change. So if that's true, then meditation is the only way to investigate that mind, because I can't see your mind. You can't see my mind. My mother can't see my mind. She gave birth to me. She can't even see my thoughts, my fears, my hopes. I could lie to her and she won't know what I really mean. So who's going to fix your mind? Well, it's you. And you might think you're not capable of, and that's not true. We're very capable. You know, we all know, number one, whenever we think of something or we have a negative intention and we hold back from doing something shitty, we know we did a good thing. You know, we know we might have just wanted to do something, but we also know we could have been way worse. We know that could have made it really bad. We could have just gone with the flow and made it really terrible. And we all know that. I think there's nobody that isn't self-aware enough to know I could have been a shitty person, but I wasn't. But my goodness, I could have been really shitty, but I wasn't.
Oh, yeah.
If that's true, the opposite is also true, and we miss this all the time. Then we know we can be a really awesome person, that we can do some incredible virtue with our mind, that we can have some stunning relationships and really build hope with ourselves and the world. And if we know we can do that, we know that the extreme of that is true. We can have extraordinary changes in the positive in our own mind. We know that. Now, how do we do that? Well, for me, that was Eastern philosophy and the study of meditation, which looks at the different lenses you can put on. And one more example, because you mentioned love, okay? Love is such a perfect relationship to this, because if anyone has ever fallen in love, like head full on, like all in, right? I'm sure everyone's had that. Oh, heart-wrenching. You look at someone's eyes and the world disappears and your own self disappears and you're like, I don't care. I'll do whatever it takes for this creature in front of me to be everything, to be happy. I'm sure parents have that when they have babies, et cetera, et cetera. Then we get our hearts broken, our hearts break, and we forget that we have that capacity. We shrink and we are afraid to love again, because the chances are we could get our hearts broken. But we want to love again because we like that feeling. We like it. We want it. But we are scared just in case we get hurt. The truth is, you're probably going to get hurt. So you either decide never to love again. You'll never risk. You'll never be vulnerable. You're guaranteed not to get hurt 100%. You're also guaranteed not to love that way again. Ouch. And I'm like, screw it. Hurt me as many times as you need to, world. I want that feeling. I'll take it. I'll take it, even if I get three loves like that or four loves like that. I'll take all the hurts in between. Please hit me. You know, like that's living, you know. And all of a sudden, the hurt doesn't hurt so much if you're expecting it also. You're like, okay, so good.
But I think that's my favorite thing about being a human is we get to experience all of these feelings and go through all of these ways of emotion. And when I finally gave into that and realized that this is what I am meant to do, like creatures, other animals, they do have feelings. But as a human, what we can feel, experience, articulate with each other is the most amazing and mind-blowing experience. And I think that's just what we are meant to be here for, is to go through those experiences together on our own. And when I finally stopped resisting that, because I was hurt and I was angry over my past and my childhood, when I finally decided to surrender and accept, then everything else felt lighter. All of the hurt I was more accepting of, because I was so excited for the possibilities of the good and the happiness and the joy, that then all of a sudden the hurt wasn't so bad. You're fully right. When something did happen, I had a different lens. I was able to experience it different. I wasn't able to take it so personally. I was able to have a few degrees of separation from certain emotions, that I was able to actually process them instead of just holding on to them so deeply and really taking ownership. I was able to let them kind of go through my body, get the experience out, and then just kind of go back to neutral again. And that's something I wasn't really able to experience for a really long time. And I truly think that it closed me off for many years for many positive experiences, because I just wasn't willing to get hurt. I wasn't willing to go through what I went through. And then it kind of just manifested more negativity in my life anyways. And it truly was one of the instances where it's like manifesting drama in your own life, because you're putting out all of that energy to stop things from happening and resisting everything so much. Do you think that's something that's extremely common nowadays, especially with younger people? I mean, we look at society, everything is hustle culture. Everyone has something better than us. There's always 5 million options for us to be dating, experiencing. You know, there's always something better out there. I'd love to hear your opinion all of that.
All of that. I loved everything you said, but here's the link of that to meditation. All of that happens as a response of your mind to circumstances. And it's not by choice. Like you said at the beginning, it was an automatic reaction, right? Meditation, the practice of meditation, is simply training your mind to choose a response rather than react. That's it. Can you train your mind to look at what is in front of you without biases, as remove as many lenses as you can to see really what's there? And then you get to choose how to respond, because that response will determine your experience of the future. Before meditation, I was just an animal reacting. You got angry at me, I get angry at you. You did something, I'd be jealous of you. And it's just a reaction. We assume that it's normal. But meditation gave me a gap between the stimuli and my response. And the longer the gap, the better my response was. Bottom line, respond with love and wisdom, because that will create a new bias, a bias through which you see everything as bare minimum a lesson, bare minimum a lesson. Everything else is plus. So like you said, I couldn't help but see, I missed out on some good opportunities because my lens wouldn't let me see them. That's exactly it. You're sitting there resisting the world. Check this out, which you understand in meditation. You watched yourself resist. The mental construct created a mental imprint of resist. That you ate, it's in your mind. It's in the movie, in the part of you that is your mind. Come some future moment and you want to share something with someone, the only frame of reference you have is resist. So you will be more likely to interpret the person's response as they're resisting, whether they are or not. All of a sudden, you're blocked from seeing what really is there, because you now have a resist bias operating all over the world. And so now you think everyone's resisting me. It's actually you. You started it a long time ago. It's just showing up now. Like any seed, it takes a long time before it ripens, but it will ripen. So every mental movement, every impulse we have that we are observing ourselves doing, and we're doing this subconsciously all the time, that leaves an imprint in our minds, the frame through which, or the lens through which we see the world, with that new bias. You're an angry person. you're going to just experience the world as being an angry world. You know, you're a joyful person. You're going to experience everyone's, even the stupid people making fun of you, you're going to go, oh, they're so joyful. And everyone's going to say, oh, she's so stupid for enjoying it, but you're actually having a good time. You see what I mean? Like, so
yeah.
Meditation is doing that on purpose, learning how to do that on purpose. Your question was about this current generation. I just turned 55 and I feel like most of my friends are in their 20s or 30s because I run Three Jewels, this meditation center, and everyone's in their 20s and 30s. I'm the old guy. Yeah. I just finished a 9-year relationship with one person. So now I'm dating. Yeah. So I'm dating as a 55-year-old in a world of 20-year-olds. And I've got all these apps to play with, right? Oh my goodness, what an eye-opening experience to see people's expectations on these apps. They get hurt so easily. I'm having fun. I'm just playing. I'm like, hello. I'm just the old guy. But people have really people are wounded in 2022. People are deeply wounded, and it's hard to imagine that you don't have to be. It's hard to imagine that there's healing to be had. And it ain't coming from the date, and it ain't coming from the app, and it ain't coming from the beverage, and it ain't coming from whatever activity. It will only ever come from the mind that you've habituated in the simulation that is the meditation. See, meditation is just like you said, I was safe in my body. I was safe in my room. Nobody's bothering me. You're just using your mind and exercising the muscle to say, I'm going to have a positive bias in the world about me and about the world. I'm just going to make an effort to choose my response and not just react like an animal. And so I practice that, and it feels blissful after a while. And then you're off the cushion, you're off the meditation simulation, and you're pitched into your everyday. You go on a date. And after a while, you don't care if the date likes you or doesn't like you. You're just interested to meet another human being who's equally going through the same things you are, and they just have a different strategy for getting happy. You know, they just want to get super drunk, and you're like, I don't want to get drunk, but I can appreciate that you want some happiness, you know, so I hung out with you. And then all of a sudden you walk through the same planet you walked at through a year or two ago, but you're seeing it like flowers. You know, like there's this image of the Buddha. I don't know if you've seen the Buddha meditating just before getting enlightenment. Enlightened, there's a bubble around him, a bubble made of rainbow light, and outside it are the four forces of evil, like there's four warriors throwing spears at him, and one is lust and one is greed, and you know, like they're saying, don't get enlightened, Buddha, right? And they're throwing weapons at him, and as the weapons go through the bubble of rainbow, which is the Buddha's perception, he can only see flowers raining on him. They see spears, he sees flowers. It's the same thing, depending on the two lenses that are looking at the thing.
No, 100%. And I think that what I heard from a lot of that as well was us just realizing how in control of our own thoughts, feelings, experiences we are. And that's something that a lot of people, when they constantly are living as if they feel like they're a victim to life, they just don't feel like they're in control of anything. Everything is happening to them. They don't have a say in it. Why is my brain doing what it's doing? And I think that's part of this whole enlightenment, is realizing that you are in control. And that first step into self-awareness is absolutely life-changing. It sounds like it's such a small step, being like, okay, like I'm just realizing I'm in control. But when you fully embody, no, I am in full control of what I think, feel, how I react, how I interact with people, it changes everything. It's necessary. And it is also a little bit painful, because then you realize that, oh, I could have been doing this 5 years ago. I could have been implementing this a little bit longer. Like, if you had full control over it, you could have done it sooner. And it's not to shame anyone. It is not to say we could have, would have, should have. Everyone has their own journey, and it will happen at the right time it is meant to. But it is the most empowering and amazing experience. I think that was the best part for me, was just realizing like how in control I was. And while I had a lot of unfortunate circumstances, I now have the ability, because outside of childhood, you are dependent on someone else. Going into adulthood, I now am in full control and I don't have to identify with a lot of my trauma, a lot of my history. I can get past all of this now. And it's a really beautiful experience. And that's definitely a theme I heard from everything that you were just explaining. It's impressive.
It's you're absolutely right. Taking the driver's seat is the key, right? And but you've got to practice that. You can't just be given a bus and then that's already on autopilot and then you're trying to figure out how to drive it. Sorry about the sirens in the background. I'm in the middle of Brooklyn. The control of how to choose your response comes with time, but you will also see the deeper states of meditation you go, you still see that there are currents, rivers of inertia that propel you to respond to in a certain way. For example, I just had, like I said, 9 years with one person, we just broke up, right? Amicably, good Buddhists, all good. But now I'm by myself, I'm watching my mind begin to give me the narratives my parents had when they separated. And they separated really badly and they hated each other and she did this to me. And I'm hearing those narratives and I didn't live those experiences with my partner, but my mind would like me to have those stories, those narratives, because that's the only narratives I built up, those frameworks. And so now the struggle is, listen, that's not true, whatever your mind is lying to you. But I can only see it because I've got the habit of looking, you see. And now that the muscle to choose, I choose to say, no, the 9 years were amazing. Oh, my God, we had the best 9 years I've ever had in any relationship. You know, at the end, it wasn't so good, but it wasn't terrible. We just think we should do different. That's the reality. But the stories that want to come up are just my mom and dad fighting, and I'm not them. And so there's even control about noticing that sometimes the inertia will overwhelm you and you don't have to be a victim of that either, you know? It's interesting. In Buddhism, there's no victim idea. Everything you have responsibility to overcome. And if something is terrible that happens to you, the worst thing you could do is react terribly to it because it'll perpetuate it. So it's this kind of logical view that your mind just experienced something terrible. Okay, at least the seed for the terrible is gone. I don't want to add more fertilizer for that seed to grow more terrible seeds. So at the bare minimum, you wish no terrible on anyone. Say, oh, that hurts so much. I wouldn't wish that on anyone. And that's a really good thing to do with the terrible. You know, it's a very different way of thinking. We think mm-hmm. eye for an eye, you know, in the West.
That's what I was going to ask you. What are some of the major differences you notice between the East and the West culture and practicing? That was a really good example. What else would you say is a major theme?
100%. This is difficult for Westerners to hear. 100% responsibility for whatever world you're stepping into. It doesn't matter how unfair the world is. Your lens is in that world. You take 100% responsibility for the lens. Yeah, I can't change the politics today. I can't change the war today. I wish I could. But my lens is, where am I being divisive? Because that's what I see in the politics. So my responsibility is to minimize my divisiveness amongst my circle of influence and control. Where am I seeing aggression between people? I can't change the war at the moment. I can protest, but I don't think that's as effective as stopping the wars that I create in my mind between people I like and I dislike. So when a Buddhist will see, when they see war, they instantly go and say, where is that seed to experience that in me? Where is it in me? Where am I warring? Where am I taking someone else's property without noticing? And you're doing a genuine investigation. And it's not the Western Catholic, which I grew up in, way of thinking about it. It's not guilt or anything like that. It's just like math. It's like, oh, my mind sees conflict. Where am I unconsciously creating conflict? I should stop that. not because I'm bad, just because I don't want to see conflict. It's like, I don't want to see conflict in my outer world, so I'll change it in my inner world. And that's where you see practitioners take vows or promises to say, I'll protect life, I'll honor other people's relationships, I'll only speak truth, because they don't want to see a world where it's full of lies and cheating and untruths. So that's one big difference, taking full personal responsibility for whatever happens. And you're not surprised if garbage happens. Garbage was going to happen whether you practiced or not. But your response to it gives you a step out of the suffering. The second big difference in the Tibetan dictionary, check this out. I grew up Catholic, right? So in the Tibetan dictionary, there's no word for guilt. They don't imagine a cult culture that doesn't have an idea of guilt. Like, can you imagine? The closest they have to this is intelligent regret. Like, you know, like accidentally you drop a cup and you're like, oh, I shouldn't have broken that. But you're not sitting there feeling guilty and useless that, oh my God, the cup broke. Now you're adding your own suffering to the cup, right? Oh my God, the cup broke. I'm a terrible person. I'm a terrible person. Everyone hates me. Why did you have to think those things? That's nothing to do with the cup. The cup broke. You wish you hadn't. Now clean the cup. That's probably the best thing you can do in the moment. You don't have to add your own trauma to it, right? So in just the idea that there's a bunch of people walking around without the idea that they're walking around guilty, that they're just going, oh, I could have been more careful next time I'm at a cafe. I better be more careful. That's the lesson there. See, it turns into a lesson that lets you grow versus a freeze response, which is guilt, which is the most useless state of mind that I can think of. Like, there's no goodness to, there's nothing good about guilt. But we all have it, I know, in the West. I mean, I have it still, you know. So that's another big difference. The biggest difference, and this, I don't know how controversial this is going to be, but I'm going to go for it because I think you have a really cool young audience. Yeah. It would be difficult in religious circles to say, I practice Christianity because I want to be Jesus. Like, that's sort of blasphemy. You don't want to do that. Like, in Buddhism, Buddha's not someone you want to become. You don't want to be like Buddha, sorry. You can be Buddha in the real sense of the word. The word Buddha comes from the Sanskrit root to awake, to Buddha. Yeah. And Buddha is the one who woke up. The one who woke up. Yeah. The wake upist. You know, the one who woke up. And so the practices of meditation, of really choosing your response and taking full responsibility for your world, will eventually change the lenses so much in your own mind that you will Buddha, you will wake up that the world causing you problems wasn't at all the problem. It's upside down. It was you and your narratives creating problems in a world that could be problems or could be bliss, depending on which lens you look at it from. And so in Buddhism, it would be right to say, I'm going to get enlightened. I'm going to be a Buddha, in the sense that I will wake up from the haze or the dreamlike existence that if I change my world, if I change the boyfriend, if I change the job, if I change the religion, change my hair, I will be happy. And that's the biggest lie, and that's what causes us most of the problems. In Buddhism, you can do that, and you might get a temporary change, but if you haven't changed your mindset, your mind will eventually change all those things back to normal suffering world. You need to change your mindset before your mindset can see and experience the world with this new lens. You change your mindset, your world and life changes. You change the life only and don't change your mindset, your mind will turn it back to garbage and you'll be back in the rat race. And so meditation shows you how to change your mind. It's just the gym for building mental frames, new narratives that are not limited, that are expansive. And you can, Buddha, you can wake up and all of a sudden it's not that you're powerful, like the way we think about it, but oh my God, you're powerful. You're walking around going, people, like, I'll give you an example. In the subway in New York, someone's trying to stab someone. I just jumped up and separated them as if I was the boss. I mean, someone later went, why the hell did you do that? They could have stabbed you. They could have shot you. And I'm like, I didn't think about it. I was fully confident that these people shouldn't hurt each other, you know? And they just listened to me. I opened the door, pushed one out. The door closed. The other one stayed inside yelling at himself. And I would never have done that without that much confidence and kindness. I wasn't doing it to hurt them. I knew everyone else was going to hurt them. I just did it because I knew that I would be the best agent in the world at that moment. And I felt powerful, as in, of course I can do this. I can bring peace to people. You know, I never would have done that without meditation.
I definitely have experienced what you have mentioned about you can change your life and it will be a very temporary fix. I think that it's very popular amongst millennials as well to think that traveling the world and going to new places on a regular basis is going to ultimately heal and fix and do a lot of spiritual healing, essentially, that we so crave and feel that we need. But unfortunately, it follows you. You can have that temporary fix. You can have that temporary fix in a new country, like you said, with a new haircut, with a new partner. They all can give you relief and some sense of what change could look like, but your mind catches up to you. And I feel like the further you try to run, the faster it almost catches up.
Yep.
So I think that a lot of people listening are going to be like, yeah, I've definitely been there, done that. And it's to no fault of our own. We just weren't taught to look inward. Everything is so external and everything is just so outside of us. But I'm really grateful that I'm seeing more friends, more family, just more people in my surroundings and even online, everyone's willingness to become self-aware, to take responsibility and to enter this new realm of enlightening and how they can play a part in just better and less suffering. And it's beautiful to see. I'm so in awe by the way things are moving. I would also love to hear a little bit more of your personal experience of how you really transitioned, because obviously you didn't grow up. You mentioned that already. It was a very, very different childhood that you were brought into. So I'd really love to hear your experience with getting into Buddhism, the difference between, you know, your childhood and what you're experiencing now.
Okay, so a couple of things, because I know we don't have a lot of time left, but there's a couple of things there. I was the most hesitant Buddhist. I wasn't interested at all because I had said goodbye to all organized religion in my 20s. I thought everyone's stupid. The dogma's too much. There's more evil than good. So when I met this monk, my immediate reaction was just rejection. It was like, you're just another dumb person, thinks that you've got an answer. And so I really had that for about 2 years. So please don't think that I'm like, oh, live and light and crystals. On the opposite, I was walking the planet reading Ayn Rand, Atlas Shrugged. And, you know, I was like not a bit interested. And then I think, like most people that enter the depth of their spiritual core, you have something happen to you that is so painful that your natural nominal answers aren't enough, you know? And so I got desperate at some point. And you can see the story of that in my TED Talk. I don't know if you've seen my TED Talk. So that it was sort of that was the moment where I went to that monk that I'd met. And I said, listen, give me some of your stupid practices. I didn't say it this way. I said it nicely, but this is what I meant. I'm like, whatever, fine. Tell me if your stupid thing works. Tell me how to change this bastard, because this is a terrible thing in my life. I'm broken. And he said, okay, do it this way, this way, this way. Practice this thing. It's a kind of meditation and then off the cushion meditation. And I did it to the T. I don't know what compelled me to not cheat, but I did. Basically, because I wanted to do it so perfectly that I could go back to him and say, see, you were wrong. You're stupid too. Part of me was like, I'm going to do it so well. And yes, when it fails, when it doesn't remove my pain, then you're to blame, not me. I think I had that thinking.
Mm-hmm.
But I did it really well and it worked and it blew my mind. It broke me open in a way that it was extraordinary. to have a completely horrible, painful, traumatic experience transform in a period of 3 months into the most uplifting, eye-opening, expansive moment of my life that then created the rest of my Buddhist search. Wow. You know, I bow down and say thank you to the horrible, terrible trauma that I experienced with that person. Really, I do. Like, really, I do. I can't see that as a problem anymore. I see it as a blessing. And therein lies the result. Because, oh, I've got so many things to say, that we do this with terrible things as well. If you've ever been depressed or negative state of mind, when we're in that state, we look back at yesterday, our relationships, our job, and we look at it through the lens of that depression, and everything's heavy. Yeah, my relationship is the reason I'm this way, and my family is the reason that, and I can't even enjoy. Like when I went to that stupid trip in Cancun, I was even depressed then. Like your current state of mind forces you to believe that it was alive all along. It reframes all your history. The fact is you probably had fun in Cancun, right? But right now you don't think you did. And that's a natural mechanism of the mind. Now get this. To Buddha, to wake up, we use that same mechanism, the bias of the moment, fill it with insight, understanding how reality works and bliss, and then look at all of our past history, and all of a sudden the worst traumas can be as powerful as this enlightening moment you have right now. So you change your lens to, oh my God, I can wake up. Oh my God, this feels blissful. You can look at the worst memories and go, there was something that I grew from that. So just as we can get depressed and review our history and say, I was always depressed, equally, we can Buddha and say, my whole history, the good and the bad, made me this powerful being that I am today. Hooray for my life. And you have gratitude for what you previously had resentment for. I don't know.
I think that is the most perfect note to end on. Hector, thank you so much for coming on and speaking. I am very, very, very grateful for your time. Where can everyone find you? And I'm going to leave in the show notes a link to the TED Talk, because I highly, highly, highly recommend everyone listen to it after this. It's an excellent resource. So where can everyone find you and connect with you?
Sure. So if you go to 3jewels.org, which is our nonprofit in New York City, we do a bunch of meditation classes free or by donation, right? So you can become an online member of $21 or something, or you can donate whatever you can. And we keep giving away this stuff for people that can't afford it. And those that can't afford it help pay for everyone. So we're a nonprofit. So that's one thing. You can check me out on Instagram, and I am Wake Uppest. And if you'll see what programs we run there. 3Jewels has been around 25 years. This is where I learned this stuff. And now this is what I lead and teach at this place. And then I think the other thing I want to say is there are many ways to practice. Meditation is definitely a discipline, but I'm sure you heard we've got this gala coming up May 5th called the Med Gala. Yeah, Meditation Gala, the Med Gala. We're raising funds so people come, pay tickets, they get three extraordinary artists, which I can't say because of contract at the moment, but they can look it up in about a week. And it's like really good musicians, DJs, Daybreaker will be there, and a whole bunch of folk. The Big Quiet, which traveled with Oprah. Well, it's a gathering of all people who want to look at their minds and for 4 hours party and be your enlightened self. Forget your traumas, your garbage. Dress up to the hill. Come in heels, red carpet. We're going to do photography, red carpet. There'll be a 10-minute meditation, and the rest of it is dancing, joyful music, light show, and people just being nice to each other. It's a sober event. And so there are many ways to access your highest potential. It doesn't have to be, I'm an austere monk. It has to be applying your beautiful mind to the life that you already have, at your job, in your relationships, looking at yourself in the mirror. And so May 5th, come to the Med Gala, and you can look that up. Actually, if you go to my Wake Uppest, there's a $15 discounted tickets. And it's just a party. I encourage people to look at us, 3Jewels, Med Gala, or my Instagram.
Thank you so much for listening. And don't forget to share this episode. It's the only way that the podcast will grow. And I appreciate your support. I'll see you next time.